From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Just a few weeks ago, I talked on the show with Mike Spees. Mike is a reporter for The Trace, a website that covers guns and the gun industry, and he contributes to The New Yorker as well. One of the things that Mike talked about was the precarious financial state of the NRA. He said that pensions there had been frozen. And one detail that really surprised me, Mike said that the NRA had stopped providing free coffee in the office, which is never a good sign for any business. Over the years, we've come to think of the NRA as practically omnipotent in Washington and in many state capitals as well. But the problems, financial and legal, run very deep. Here's Mike Spees.
So back in March, last month, Wayne LaPierre, the NRA's top official, sent out a fundraising letter to his members. And it was what I would describe as an urgent plea for money. And what he was telling them specifically was, we're facing an attack that's unprecedented, not just in the history of the NRA, but in the entire history of our country. The Second Amendment cannot survive without the NRA, and the NRA cannot survive without your help right now. Wayne LaPierre is right. The NRA is troubled. In 2017, the organization had to borrow millions of dollars from its foundation, from its officers' life insurance policies, and it also liquidated several million more dollars from an investment fund. I wanted to find out the root cause of why the NRA is convulsing. One of the people I spoke with was Aaron Davis. Davis started at the NRA in 2005 and worked for a decade in the organization's fundraising department. He grew up with the NRA, reading its magazines as a boy. And for him, working at the organization was a kind of dream.
Part of the allure of working at the NRA was you could feel the power. You were intimidated by the power, but you respected it and you looked up to it. And we felt that the folks we were working for were top-notch and didn't even think about what did they make. Now, of course, you'd heard, oh, I think this person makes $400,000 a year, and you're like, what? That doesn't make sense. But when you're in your meetings, you're thinking, oh my gosh, this person is going to change America. We're going to be the best organization there ever was on the face of the planet, and so whatever they cost, that's what they cost.
The key to the NRA's problems is what it does with money. I've been searching through tons of documents, federal tax forms, charity records, contracts, corporate filings, and internal communications. And it seems a small group of NRA executives, contractors, and vendors have extracted hundreds of millions of dollars from the nonprofit's budget, enriching themselves in the process. Central to this story is a for-profit public relations firm called Ackerman McQueen.
So Ackerman McQueen was a very professional for-profit organization, a marketing firm, if you will, that had been doing a lot of projects around NRA. They weren't NRA members by any stretch.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they were just paid to be part of a marketing firm. So they're your typical, like, New York, Austin types, but they weren't your folks who were interested in Second Amendment politics.
For more than three decades, Ackerman has shaped the NRA's public identity, helping to build it from a niche activist organization into a ubiquitous presence in American culture. Ackerman has produced and devised the NRA's most successful and divisive ad campaigns. In fact, when you're hearing from the NRA, most of the time, you're really hearing from Ackerman McQueen.
We stop this. The only way we save our country and our freedom is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
The NRA and Ackerman have become so intertwined that it's often difficult to tell where one ends and the other begins. In Aaron's fundraising department, They were going after big money donors with highly produced marketing materials that cost a lot of money to make. In 2008, Aaron's boss was a guy named Ben Case, who had been at the organization for several years.
Ben hired what I still perceive to be the guru, and I'm not going to say his name, but this, the guru of major guest fundraising in all of the nation. He hires him to come in and give us a day-long training to raise more money. And we say, we're having trouble. We're not raising like what we think. And so he holds up one of our marketing materials that Ackerman had produced. And he goes, this actually will hurt you from raising big money. Donors don't want to see that you're spending so much money when they give a large gift. The best types of fundraising materials are black and white with a couple of, you know, color photos. And there was an argument right there between some of our, especially one of our directors, and this fundraising guru saying, no, that's not true. And so it was, that always had that in my mind, like, well, if this is more effective, why are we doing it this way?
2 years after this seminar, Ben Case was removed from his position, and a former Ackerman McQueen executive, Tyler Schrupp, was installed in his place. Tyler, unlike Ben, had limited fundraising experience, and as soon as he took over, most of the fundraising team's outside business was sent to Ackerman McQueen.
They were so close to us. They were always in our offices. Their account executive was always in our offices, and he was doing projects with us, and it, our budget was increasing. We were doing more of that sort of thing. But in my 10 years of fundraising there, I saw that fundraising at NRA was very difficult. We had, I'd say at least 80% of our fundraisers didn't raise as much as they cost. Wow. It was not an easy place to raise big dollars for.
After Tyler came in, do you have a sense overall of how much of the total expenses being generated by the advancement team were ultimately being steered into Ackerman McQueen's coffers?
I don't. That was kept under wraps.
It was kind of, yeah.
I only saw my budget, and but overall, I did not know where all the money went. So it just rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I kind of want to make that point that this is not something that, oh, Aaron feels like something's being done wrong. It was the entire department, from what I could tell, felt the same way. We all felt that there was too much of this, like, insider baseball type thing. It was not, it did not seem above the bar. And we felt bad about it. A lot of us felt bad about it.
Which is interesting, right? Because you would think that those expenses would have to be justified in some sense. There'd have to be some clear return on the big investment.
Absolutely. And a lot of board members kind of knew that.
In 2017, the NRA paid Ackerman McQueen and its affiliates almost $41 million. That number accounted for 12% of the organization's total expenses that year. So you've got a company that is sucking up a huge amount of the NRA's budget and is also exerting an incredible amount of control over the organization.
They're a for-profit organization trying to make money, trying to do things that would bring more money to them. So they have completely different intentions than a nonprofit should have, which is for the common good, for the better good. And so those lines were just so blurry. But as you read and you learn the laws and you see what the IRS is writing, you get to this kind of push and pull. And it even made me question anything I was saying in donor meetings when I was pushing gifts. Is this okay? Can I have this meeting with this congressperson? Is that okay? You know, am I supposed to be even doing an event with Rob Portman? I don't know.
Right, right. There's almost like an inherent conflict of interest.
I think so. I think there is an inherent conflict of interest. It just doesn't seem, and I think one of the reasons I'm willing to come forward is it just doesn't seem like NRA leadership is all that concerned about this.
The Ackerman relationship is just one example of a host of opaque, sketchy arrangements that the NRA leadership has forged over a number of years. It goes beyond just the NRA's inflammatory rhetoric. It's a systemic problem that infects the entire organization. I actually got copies of internal handwritten memos. They were created by Emily Cummins, who until November was the NRA's managing director of tax and risk management. So I'm looking at one of the pages now, and you can see that Emily has flagged a list of top concerns. The memos assert that the NRA pays overbilled, deceptive, vague invoices to preferred vendors and contractors. Staff is told to process payments without documentation. And the memos also say, and this is perhaps maybe the worst thing, that the board hasn't been told of what's embarrassing. And that's the part that rubs up against nonprofit law. If a business arrangement poses an obvious conflict of interest, the board has a responsibility to not only know about the arrangement, but it also has to provide a reasonable justification for okaying it. And if they don't, then that's a major red flag. And the NRA, as it turns out, has a number of red flags. Now, nonprofit law is fairly murky. So I spoke with the former head of the IRS's nonprofit division. And he told me that if these red flags are in fact violations of the law, that the New York Attorney General could take a number of actions. The Attorney General could sanction board members or disband the board or go to court and ultimately argue that the organization is so far gone that it could be disbanded entirely.
Developing right now, the National Rifle Association is suing one of its longtime ad partners.
We're talking about Ackerman McQueen Advertising Agency.
In a surprising twist, the NRA has now turned on its longtime collaborator. Earlier this month, the NRA filed a lawsuit against Ackerman McQueen over concerns about Ackerman's activities and accounting practices, suggesting that the NRA doesn't actually know the details of its most significant business arrangement.
A conflict of interest, but we will see what the court does next. In the newsroom, Grant Herms, Oklahoma's Own News 9.
And yet all this financial stuff doesn't completely explain why Aaron Davis, who had been so proud to work for the NRA, is taking the rare step of blowing the whistle. Aaron, like many of his co-workers, believed wholeheartedly in the mission of the NRA. But the NRA, as a big institution, doesn't welcome dissent. People who have spoken out have been marginalized or even shunned. So for Aaron, the best way forward in the end was just to quit.
In a way, Mike, it kind of feels like you're drinking the Kool-Aid. And while some of what NRA says is right, I mean, it is an American organization that loves America. I don't know if they love Americans. I don't know if they love people that don't look like them, because it's all about politics and winning. And that especially came to a head at Sandy Hook after that happened. And in the office, as I was sitting in the office, and we actually had the lights out in the office. We weren't allowed to send emails. That period of time between when the shooting happened to when Wayne LaPierre actually spoke, which I think was like 7 or 9 days, we weren't even allowed to really do work, but we still had to come into the office. And we were scared. The staff was scared we're going to lose our jobs, that NRA is over. And the message that came from Wayne, we didn't hear until he came on TV.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Would you rather have your 911 call bring a good guy with a gun?
And after the television interview, which I thought didn't go well, it wasn't empathetic at all, everyone in the office was just like, oh my gosh, we won. And I don't know how you win something like that. I don't know how, and you know, everyone felt better after that. And except for maybe there was my manager at the time, she was scared for her children's life.
Right.
That was like the extent of it. But it's like, let's move on. We won that battle, that political battle. Let's go on.
Right.
And it just, that's not okay. I mean, that's not who we are as humans.
Right.
We have to be more cognizant. You know, you can have a belief in the Second Amendment, and you can believe that it's an individual right and Supreme Court, this and that. But you have to care about people that are citizens of this country. I just feel like there's a sickness of the heart within NRA leadership.
That's Aaron Davis speaking with reporter Mike Spies. Davis worked for the NRA from 2005 to 2015. You can find Mike Spies' reporting on the NRA at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this year, a group of young climate activists, children mostly, showed up at Senator Dianne Feinstein's office, and they were there to talk about the Green New Deal. And suddenly, things got pretty testy.
The government is supposed to be for the people and by the people and all for the people.
You know what's interesting about this group is I've been doing this for 30 years. You come in here, and you say it has to be my way or the highway. I don't respond to that.
Those activists who ticked off Senator Feinstein were part of the Sunrise Movement. Apart from a membership that's very young, the Sunrise Movement sounds pretty different from the big environmental groups like the Sierra Club, say. Rather than talking about the fate of polar bears or coral reefs, they tend to frame the issue in these terms. We're the ones who are going to suffer if we don't do something really fast.
Even though the idea of the Green New Deal has been around for at least a decade, it's really taken on legs because of the Sunrise Movement.
Here's Eliza Griswold, a staff writer who's just won the Pulitzer Prize.
It was really fascinating during the midterms to get to watch what impact the young people had, particularly in Pennsylvania, that I was covering the swing state, and looking at them on the ground, just the number of doors they knocked was incredibly inspiring.
Eliza talked recently with Varshini Prakash, the 25-year-old co-founder of the Sunrise Movement.
One of the things that I find so exciting about both Sunrise and the Green New Deal is this, the idea of climate justice, that finally environmental justice and the climate change movement are getting on the same page.
Well, part of how I think about this is if we look at the last, you know, few decades of climate movement activity and of climate policy, just focusing on the climate alone has not been a winning strategy. One of the reasons why I think the Green New Deal actually has a chance at building this winning coalition of lots of different diverse constituencies is that it's fundamentally about tying climate action to people's basic interests, right? Like jobs and the economy and health and healthcare. It includes a 10-year economic mobilization to transform every part of our economy and society to stop the climate crisis and get us off of fossil fuels. The second piece of it is that we ought to guarantee a job to every person who wants or needs one doing the critical work of avoiding climate catastrophe. And so people might immediately balk at a word like decarbonization or climate change or something like that, but everyone cares about access to clean air and clean water. Everybody cares about having access to a good, high-paying job and being able to support their family.
Okay, so that's the plan on addressing communities and garnering community support. How do you plan to get such an ambitious agenda through Congress?
Yes, the path to power here, or to victory. I think about this in a few different ways. First of all, of course, we need to replace Trump. We need to elect pro-climate action, pro-good jobs majorities into the House and the Senate. At the same time, we need to be building big, robust, massive movements that include millions of people for social change to be keeping up the pressure on the outside. So I think the biggest thing that we need to ensure is that we are setting ourselves up so that 2 years from now, when the political conditions are ripe, we have built the political will and we have built also the public consensus, the public support, so that we can pass these policies when the window of opportunity arises. And it's going to be very similar to how FDR's New Deal occurred as well. FDR didn't get up and say, you know, we have a New Deal policy that's 10,000 pages long and we're going to pass it in one fell swoop. He sort of embraced what he called bold experimentation over a decade of time, where he threw dozens and dozens of policies at the wall and saw what stuck. And I think we need to embrace this experimentation as well in our politics today and do whatever it takes to really pass the policies that are going to prevent us from going over this tipping point that we are on the verge of.
Okay, Varshini, what do you say to criticism like, how are you going to manage decarbonization in this particular time frame when there is no carbon-free option for, say, jet fuel? When people bear down on some of the specifics and say these are great goals, mm-hmm. but they are impossible technologically to mm-hmm. achieve in this time. What's your response to that?
I mean, there have been lots of people telling us that are radical, that we are unrealistic, that we're naive. We've heard it all at this point. I don't know if we can completely decarbonize our economy in the next 10 years. I don't know if we can eliminate all warming emissions, but we have done incredible things in this nation's history before. We have an amazing track record. You know, we are facing this grave existential threat, a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. Scientists are telling us there will be, you know, 150 million climate refugees by mid-century. 150 million. All of our coral reefs will be gone. Hundreds of millions of premature deaths from pollution. We don't have a choice but to strive. And I think in striving, we can open up all sorts of political opportunities and perhaps technological opportunities than we could have ever before.
Recently, the AFL-CIO came out against the Green New Deal, saying that it could cause, quote, I think, immediate harm to millions of union workers. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complicated issue. And I don't think it's an issue that's going to be completely solved in mere days or weeks. I do believe that the Green New Deal has the greatest chance of actually bringing both labor and enviros and businesses and more farmers and ranchers, indigenous communities to the table, because I think it's the first time that we have articulated a vision to stop climate change that's actually rooted in a just transition, in justice and equity, and it is also about economic revitalization. Many of these unions actually represent working families and communities of color that are already experiencing the impacts of climate change. I was talking to the head of one major union the other day who said that over 70,000 of their union workers had been affected by Hurricanes Harvey and Florence, and that they had had to shell out hundreds of thousands of dollars to support these individuals. So this is hurting union members right now, and a lot of people understand that. Many people are very much on the same page about the need to do something about it. And now we need to actually have communication with both not just leaders at the top, but at the grassroots as well, to bring the majority of folks along.
Do you support primary campaigns against Democrats who don't back the Green Deal?
Yeah, we will. Definitely.
So the Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe called the Green New Deal the gift that keeps on giving. How concerned are you that Republicans are going to use policies to address climate as a bludgeon against Democrats?
I'm not that concerned, frankly. We're seeing that The Green New Deal has absolutely skyrocketed into the public conversation and the nation's discourse over the last 5 months. What used to be a relatively niche policy priority is now becoming the number one most popular policy amongst Democratic 2020 caucus goers. And even majorities of Republicans, even conservative Republicans, who are very much in support of things like investments in sustainable agriculture and renewable energy, supporting energy efficiency programs, and interested in the job creation component of the Green New Deal as well. So I think, you know, Republicans will continue to use this to bash whomever, but frankly, they're the ones who end up looking pretty ludicrous in the end.
But one of the talking points for Green New Deal opponents is this: they're going to take away our hamburgers, which obviously you've heard, I'm sure. How do you deal with people who belong to an opposition that is really hostile, that isn't engaging in the debate in a substantive way? How do you begin to reach those people?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I will say I don't think you can reach everybody. I think the key is to make sure that some of these key individuals who sort of passively support action on climate or support these policies, like, for example, there are a lot of farmers and ranchers in the Heartland and in the Midwest and places that you see this terrible rhetoric around, you know, we're going to kill your cows and take your hamburgers and all of that manifesting most strongly. A lot of those folks are really interested in investments in sustainable agriculture and improving livelihoods for farmers and ranchers and ensuring that people have access to good food. But in large part, the Democratic Party and the climate movement writ large has failed to actually go out and talk to these people on the ground. And that's like the first thing that our movement is trying to do and needs to do to win on this moving forward.
Varshini Prakash is co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, and she spoke with The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold. The Green New Deal is the most ambitious climate proposal ever brought to Congress, coming to the table during one of the most divisive periods we've ever seen. No one knows better than Carol Browner how hard this legislation will be to pass. Browner is a veteran of D.C. politics, chief of the EPA under Bill Clinton, and the so-called climate czar under Barack Obama. And neither of those administrations, it's got to be said, was able to make any real dent in the climate crisis. Carol Browner spoke recently with The New Yorker's John Cassidy.
I mean, just to set this in a bit of historical context, if we perhaps just go back to the Obama administration, which did have a lot of green policies, cap and trade, fuel efficiency standards, sort of clean air regulations, which the Republicans depicted as a war on coal, etc. Perhaps you could just remind us what the Obama administration tried to do on the environment and how far it succeeded and how far it failed.
Well, I think President Obama came to office with a strong commitment to address climate change. And there were laws on the books. He didn't need Congress. He could use the existing Clean Air Act, the existing transportation laws, to actually set standards, to make cars more fuel efficient, to set the first ever greenhouse gas standards, to set appliance efficiency standards, to regulate pollution from power plants. And so he set out to do all of that. He simultaneously went to Congress and said, let's pass a cap-and-trade bill, the Waxman-Markey bill. It did pass in the House. Unfortunately, it did not pass in the Senate. But, you know, then Obama first went to Copenhagen, where there was an international discussion on climate change, then goes to Paris, where we secure a global deal where each country will deliver to the best of their abilities. And, you know, I think that President Obama deserves a lot of credit for sort of moving the actions along, not just saying words, but actually taking concrete steps. Right. I think the Green New Deal takes another big step forward in terms of its aspirations, in terms of its ambitions.
But it seems like the Green New Deal approach is pretty different to the Obama administration. I mean, it seems to me one of the things about the Green New Deal is it's got a sort of, whether you agree with it or not, it's got a sort of conceptual framework behind it. They've got this target for the IPCC of hitting zero Z emissions by 2050. They say that in order to get there, you've got to basically have a clean power grid by 2030. That's been misinterpreted in some places, saying the whole thing's got to be done by 2030, but it's a very ambitious agenda. Does that make it different from the Obama administration? I mean, did you guys have a sort of overall target in your minds?
I think one of the things I learned and the administration learned from Waxman Markey is that sort of a one-size-fits-all economy-wide approach was probably not going to get us what we needed, and that you could look at the various sectors that contribute to carbon pollution and develop programs around those sectors.
Right.
And so, for example, what you do with cars might be, you know, set fuel efficiency standards, set greenhouse gas standards, drive towards new technologies, new forms of micromobility, for example. What you do for power plants might be different. Power plants are very familiar with a cap and trade regime, so you could use that. But it's, I think what the Green New Deal is very clear about is that we need very, very bold ambitions and that there's not one solution out there.
I mean, there does seem to be, certainly among young voters, there does seem to be an appetite for sort of, you know, radical approaches to this and sort of feeling that the policies in the past have failed.
I don't know that I agree that they've failed.
Oh, sorry,
they haven't been, as someone who's been a party to a lot of them, what I would say they have been less than perfect. But you know, the way environmental regulations work is they're building blocks. So you look at the science and you set a smog standard and you achieve reductions. You regulate industries who create smog, who emit ozone. And then you look again and again and again, right? And you make these building blocks that get you where you want to go.
Right. Sorry. I what I meant is that they failed to sort of reverse climate change so far.
That's fair. That's fair.
What about the cost of all this? You know, that's obviously the Republicans, and I would imagine some Democrats, too, at some point are going to raise the issue of whether this is, you know, feasible. Are we going to have to raise taxes? I mean, you see various figures, sort of $10 trillion over a long time. Is that feasible politically, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think these numbers are hard to follow, and they're sort of based on a lot of sort of guesses slash assumptions, I guess. I think it's important to look at history here. We have time and time again set strong environmental regulatory standards. And there have been naysayers at the time who said, oh, we'll never be able to meet that standard. But once the EPA sets that standard, once it is an enforceable standard, American innovation and ingenuity rises to the challenge and we find a new and cheaper way to get it done. Virtually every single major regulation that has come out of the Environmental Protection Agency to protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, has been met for far less money than was originally thought, because we're good at finding solutions. And you know, part of the challenge of climate change is we need to get going. We need to set these standards. And then it becomes the art of the possible. And I think we'll be good at that.
Right.
So I think it's really hard to, with a huge amount of accuracy, sort of project what the impact, the economic impacts are going to be.
But I mean, before we get there, we're going to have to build a sort of political coalition for this. And already tensions are emerging. The Republicans are already starting to sort of demagogue this and, you know, saying Democrats are going to take away your hamburgers, et cetera.
I've been there. They accused me. Let me see. What was it? I was going to take away your barbecue grill. That was one of them.
You've got the AFL-CIO as being very resistant to the Green New Deal, so you're not really getting much Labour buy-in. And then on the environmentalist side, you're getting people in the Sunrise Movement saying that they'll only support primary candidates who, you know, go along with their approach. So there seems to be a thread of, you know, sort of internecine conflict inside the Democratic Party on this. How are we going to build a coalition which can, you know, overcome what is, at the moment, a Republican Senate? The Green New Deal people would say we need a big grassroots campaign. It's the only way we're going to get 60 senators, et cetera.
Well, I agree. We need a big grassroots campaign, without a doubt. We also need industry. We need industry leaders to step up. They're very influential with members of Congress, with members of the Senate.
Is it realistic to expect the power industry, gas companies, oil companies to, you know, it sounds a bit like turkeys voting for Christmas. Are they ever going to agree to this?
Well, I think there are some that have seen the future. You know, they're also getting a lot of pressure from their investors.
Right.
There is a shareholder resolution filed with Exxon. It is supported by, I think, 9 investors, large investment companies that represent $9 trillion in assets under management,
right?
You know, if you look at the long history of environmental protection in this country, sort of pollution efforts as opposed to conservation, what you will see is people start to move forward and then Congress follows because you have to set a floor.
Right.
It may not ever be as much as we all hope for, but it will be a step, and then we have to argue for more.
Right. I mean, when you were doing cap and trade, you actually got some buy-in from the energy industry?
We did.
Right.
We did have some buy-in. in, particularly in the House during the Waxman-Markey debate.
Right. I mean, I think some people in the Green New Deal movement would like to just sort of say, let's just mobilize and crush the corporations here. They're never going to agree with us. We just need, instead of trying to do deals with them, what we need to do is mobilize the public, get mass support, and just vote the legislation through, and they'll have to deal with it then.
Well, we need 60 votes. And so the question is, how do you put together 60 votes? And one piece of it is the grassroots, and I applaud them and I encourage them to continue. But the other is, you know, working with industry, working with investors, working with all parties to get to 60 votes. You know, at the end of the day, I don't really care why you vote the way you do. I just care that you vote the right way. So I have to find an argument that appeals to you.
But I mean, it's still at some point, somebody's going to have to stand up to the fossil fuel industry and say, you have to do this. I mean, you've been in this game for as long as anybody, 30 years. Are you optimistic, more optimistic now than you were? How do you sort of view the current situation?
Well, I am optimistic in part because I just don't believe I'm 60-something that my generation is going to give to my grandchildren a problem they can't solve. I think that one of the consequences of all of the delays to date is we can't only talk about reducing carbon pollution anymore. We have to talk about adaptation. We have to talk about rehabilitation. You know, we have to talk about the whole panoply of things that we will do. But I think that we are making progress. And I give the new members of Congress a lot of credit for raising their voices.
Carol Browner, climate advisor to Barack Obama and chief of the EPA during the Clinton administration. She spoke with John Cassidy, a staff writer at The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and coming up, we'll hear from Patricia Marks about a career change plan that can't possibly fail. Or so she thinks. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us today. I'm David Remnick, and now I'm going to turn things over to Patricia Marks. Don't worry, you're in good hands.
As a writer, I spend a lot of time at my computer thinking of careers I should have chosen instead. And high on my list is being the conductor of an orchestra. You know, there are some jobs and endeavors that look impossibly hard, like computer programming or landmine removal or swing dancing. But conducting, I just thought, how hard really can it be? So I think I've got what it takes. I know how to clap on time. I know the difference between loud and soft. And I have free time. Miraculously, the Orchestra of St. Luke's, a very prestigious orchestra, gave me 36 musicians to play with. That's three dozen. And they let me conduct the Haydn Symphony No. 45, which they were rehearsing that day because they were going to play it at Carnegie Hall.
Hi, Patty.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Likewise. Great.
I was introduced to the real conductor, Bernard Labadie, from Montreal, and he is an specialist in classical and Baroque music. So we're looking at this score.
Yeah.
There are many, many, many pages.
Yeah, and that's a small score because there are not so many instruments. If we'd be doing Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, you would be facing a huge wall of notes and lines. But in the Haydn Symphony, it's something much lighter.
And there's a line for each instrument, correct?
Exactly, and it's clearly written, so you see
that
the top
one,
line is
oboe two.
Fagotto is bassoon.
A bassoon. Corno one in a la must be a horn.
It's a horn, definitely. Okay. The second
violino must be.
Well, so there are two horns.
There are
it's
two
important,
horns.
You know, and that's an important
two
part
two oboes.
Your, yeah.
One bassoon.
Bassoon. Two horns, but it's important.
So why do they call it fagotto instead
fagotto
of a bassoon?
Fagotto is it's the Italian word for bassoon.
Okay,
fagotto
they
in
make
German.
Everything sound like pasta. So are your gestures, you prepare so much, are your gestures
planned or do you feel it in the moment?
Well, and when you learn how to conduct, you have to learn the gestures. Uh-huh. And you have to learn the impact of gestures on musicians.
Uh-huh.
And also you learn to adapt them to the different musicians you're working with.
So it's not specifically choreographed?
No, I mean, it's part, how could I say that? It's not choreographed, meaning that...
It's like you're dancing with the orchestra.
To some extent, but I'm maybe it would be more precise to say that I'm dancing ahead of the orchestra, because my job is to convey through my gestures how I want the music to sound like. We are usually one beat ahead.
How can I tell, as an audience member, how can I separate a good from a great conductor?
The truth is in the music that you hear. What I mean is you cannot really trust what you see, because sometimes some conductors have a very, you know, weird conducting technique, and it seems offensive or anything, but the results are fabulous.
I thought what Bernard said was very reassuring. If I interpreted this right, he said it really doesn't matter what you do as long as you do it extremely, even if it's offensive. So I brought my own baton, which I had gotten for $8 on Amazon. I could have splurged for more, but I thought, how good does a baton have to be? Though I also thought, why don't they give me two? I don't know why. I guess I was thinking of chopsticks or something.
You don't need to use a baton to conduct. It's not an absolute necessity. It can help. And I would say it helps, especially if you have a very large orchestra. If you're in the pit and people have a harder time seeing you, what it does is that it focuses the message.
Right.
It concentrates the message of the hand into one point, which is easier to read. But it's a matter of choice, I would say.
Well, I like toys, so I'm going to use it.
It's a big toy, yeah.
Fencing without a sword or being a jockey without a whip.
Yeah, but be careful. It can be dangerous. I'm well known in Quebec City for having stuck one of these up my nose in rehearsal and ending up in emergency room at the hospital.
So I walk up to the podium, and not only am I holding a deadly weapon, but I look at the orchestra and I think, shit, I can't do this. It's terrifying. Maybe sticking the baton up my nose isn't such a bad idea, because surely that would be an easier route to go than trying to conduct 36 musicians. But there was kind of no turning back.
So the tricky thing, of course, is to make you start together.
Here goes. What? What's wrong? What did I do?
So one beat of preparation, one, two.
Bernard is sort of telling me to do things that I don't understand with the beat, and that I didn't even know it was possible to hold a baton the wrong way, but I was. I thought it would be like tennis, you know, shake hands with the racket, but it's not that. So I proceeded to raise my arm up and down and occasionally outward and hope for the best. Clearly, these guys are really good because they're not getting any help from me.
Well, you actually, at some point, started beating suddenly much quicker.
That's good, right?
Not necessarily. I think it's supposed to be in the same tempo.
Okay.
And that's because you
started slowing down. I wanted to personalize it.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so we'll do it. Well, let's do it really fast and with regret.
May I suggest something? Let's do it with only one hand. You don't need the two.
That's right.
You can do
I
this.
Want it to be a megalomaniac, though.
That will come in due time, trust me.
Okay.
So...
So I suggest that let's try to consciously shift the tempo.
Okay.
If you start beating a little quicker, they will follow you. If you start beating a little slower, but like trying to get quicker, accelerate, and then decelerate just to see how they react to it.
So I decide to take some amphetamines here. And here I took an Ambien. And now it's worn off. So obviously, I've mastered the craft of conducting. I sound pretty good. The orchestra sounds good. I know what I'm doing. But maybe it's a little cookie cutter. Maybe it's like every other conductor on the block. I decided I wanted to stand out. I want now to create a visual repertoire. I want to put my personality into my technique, add to the language maybe. I want to be one of the greats. So here I am pointing at people in the orchestra. I'm leaping and I'm glissading. I'm swatting flies. I'm trying to hitchhike. I'm playing with my hair. Here, I started doing a little yoga. Could we call this sublime?
I have to say, this is easier to work than my TV.
I want to be careful because I do want to come across as humble. But, dare I say, I've impressed myself. If there's another baton accident, call me.
Patty Marks. She's been contributing to The New Yorker since 1989.
Will you talk to us for... Do you want to talk?
We're both named Melanie, by the way.
Oh, Melanie's. Will you talk to us?
Okay.
And which instrument? I think I know, but which... You were...
Oboe.
Double bass.
Double bass. How'd they do?
You did okay. there were moments that you did really well, and then there were moments that you had too much fun.
So if this were a report card, you'd say shows improvement.
No, I'm not kidding.
Keep your day job.
That's the Orchestra of St. Luke's with Bernard Labadie conducting.
Piano.
No musicians were harmed in the making of our story. Not permanently, anyway. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.